My guest today is Thomas Mullen. When you visit his website, here's the first thing you'll read. Thomas Mullen lives a deceptively quiet life not far from downtown Atlanta. While SUVs drive by and dogs bark and the locals suspect not a thing, he commits murders, spins wildly convoluted conspiracy theories, travels through time, reinvents the past, resurrects the dead, falls in love with women of his own invention, imperils young children, unleashes plagues, wages war, saves lives, dangles participles, and invents new metaphors. Most of his sentences contain verbs. Nice. Thomas Mullen, welcome to City Lights.
Thanks very much for having me.
Oh, I love the first thing we encounter on your website.
You got to work hard to make writing sound interesting.
Ah, and you achieved that. Your new book is Dark Town. And I was hoping we could begin with you reading the description of Atlanta, which appears early in Dark Town, page 9.
Sure. And this is set in 1948. Atlanta, Georgia. Two parts Confederate racist, to two parts Negro, to one part something that doesn't quite have a name for it yet. Neither city nor country, but some odd combination. A once sleepy railroad crossing that had exploded due to the wartime need for materiel and the necessities of shipping it. Even after the war, all those factories and textile mills and rail yards were still churning, because normalcy had returned and Americans were desperate for new clothes and washing machines and automobiles, and the South was very good at providing cheap, non-unionized labor. So Atlanta continued to grow, the trains continued to disgorge new residents, and the tenements grew more crowded, and the moonshine continued to be driven down from the mountains, and the streets spilled over with even yet more passion and schemes and brawls, because there on the Georgia Piedmont, something had been set loose that might never again be contained.
When did you first decide to write this story?
A few years ago, I was reading a great book about Atlanta history called Where Peachtree Meets Sweet Auburn by a former AJC writer named Gary Pomerantz. It follows a black family and a white family through a century and a half of Atlanta history. And in the middle of this 600-page book, there's a 4-page passage about the fact that in 1948, the city of Atlanta finally hired their first 8 black police officers. It was a big political victory at the time because black community leaders had been asking mayors for years to hire black cops and kept getting pushed off. Finally, in 1948, the city did hire them. But because it was still the Jim Crow era, because it was, you know, a few years before some of the first key victories of the civil rights movement, these 8 men had to operate under a number of Jim Crow restrictions. They could only patrol the black neighborhoods. They could not drive squad cars, so they had to walk their beats. They couldn't even set foot in the headquarters because, according to a Newsweek article that came out a year before, as many as 1/4 of Atlanta cops were members of the Ku Klux Klan. So Mayor Hartsfield and Police Chief Herbert Jenkins were very concerned that the mere sight of these black men in uniform would incense the white officers, and that if the black cops dared enter the headquarters, the white cops would riot and attack them. Which wasn't an unfounded fear, because at that time in our history, there had been a number of instances where returning black soldiers who came back from war and dared to wear their uniform at a, you know, 4th of July parade or something like that were lynched. It happened a number of times in Georgia and South Carolina in the years right before 1948. So for the black officers' protection, instead of using the white headquarters, they had to operate out of a makeshift precinct located in the basement of the black YMCA on Butler Street. And last but certainly not least, they could only arrest black people. They couldn't arrest whites.
So the irony here is that they were just trying to serve and protect the public. Voter rights, that struggle was to uphold the Constitution. Americans are entitled to vote. But the insult of rejecting people who risk, who choose to risk their lives to protect you, whether in the military or in this case in the police, is just beyond comprehension. But you go into intricate detail to explain what these people were up against. What were some of these, if you could give us a rundown of not just the constraints on these policemen, the limitations on them are so ridiculous. Take us through the absurd rules that were imposed on them. You mentioned, you know, not being able to wear their uniforms into, not to be able to wear their uniforms.
Going to and from work.
To and from the police station.
Not only could they not go to the headquarters, but they had to wear the civilian clothes to the Y and then change, work their shift, and at the end of their shift, change again. And there, too, the idea was supposedly for their safety, because while they were working, they were walking in pairs. But then after work, they'd go their separate ways to walk home. And the mayor and the police chief were afraid that, you know, one lone black man in uniform walking home at 2 in the morning, which is when their shift typically ended, would be targeted by whites. And also, they were just beat cops. It was more than a decade before any of the black officers were promoted. So they weren't conducting homicide investigations and that sort of thing. So they were, you know, they were really looked down upon. And one thing I want to point out to people, sometimes people describe Darktown as a book about the integration of the Atlanta police, but that's not really true. They weren't integrated at all. This isn't like a police version of Jackie Robinson integrating the Dodgers. They were still, you know, literally segregated. They were in a different building, treated differently, had different rules, and didn't interact with white officers all that much.
In fact, one of the main characters, who turns out to be not such a horrible guy, Dennis Rakestraw, tries to reason, if you will, with some of his fellow white cops by saying, this is a better kind of segregation. Do you think he fully believed that?
Well, one of the things I wanted to tap into and that I needed to learn about more myself was, you know, what were the different opinions that white Southerners, white Atlantans had in 1948? It's very easy to generalize and say that everybody back then was a, you know, fire-breathing racist. And that, of course, isn't true. There were racial moderates, there were racial progressives. But even then, what was a white racial progressive in 1948 like? When you write historical fiction, you don't want to fall into the trap of letting the characters be too modern and say things that are too out of 2016. And that it can be very tempting, because when you're writing characters, you want to write, say you're trying to write a likable character, then you don't want them to say some horribly sexist thing. But, you know, maybe they would have said that in 1948. So you need to be honest about their attitudes about race or attitudes about gender. And so there were some progressive white Southerners, and Officer Denny Rakestraw he fits into that category, I would say. He's young, he's in his early 20s, and he just got back from World War II, where he was one of the first soldiers to see the concentration camps. And he was also raised by a German immigrant mother who was teased a lot when she was growing up for being, you know, a dirty Hun, which is what they called Germans during World War I. So he was brought up not to use racial epithets. He thinks of himself as a more forward-thinking Southerner. And having seen the Holocaust and seen the logical extension of race hatred, which is to wipe out an entire class of people, he doesn't want that to happen in the South. And the Holocaust did have a big impact on a lot of white people who hadn't really thought about race much before. It opened a lot of people's eyes. And, you know, Officer Rakestraw wants the South to be better, but at the same time, it's still 1948. How far can he really go? And I wanted to make sure that I didn't fall into the trap of, you know, writing this heroic white character, because that crops up a lot in stories, you know, either novels or movies about civil rights and the civil rights era. I think too often the white character becomes the hero, and the story is about the moral awakening of white people. And I didn't want that to happen. So I don't want to give too much away, but I will say that, you know, he's a character that he's pulled in different directions, but he's not going to be the savior of the story.
Now, although he is certainly a person with humanity, it's much more complicated. And the other characters are also vividly drawn. Mainly, we have Lucius Boggs, who is one of the black officers who feels this momentousness of the occasion when he's sworn in, that sense of responsibility. And his partner, Tommy Smith, who doesn't come from the privileged background that Lucius does. Lucius is Morehouse educated. But Tommy is much more schooled in dealing with whites. Lionel Dunlow, who could hold the title of most despicable villain, though later we learned that that would be class discrimination on our part because there are well-educated, white, moneyed people who are equally villainous to him. Two wonderful secondary characters are Uncle Percy and Mama Dove. Before we even get to Lucius and Tommy, would you talk about Mama Dove?
Mama Dove runs a brothel in town, and one of the tensions that came up when the black officers were hired is that obviously they wanted to shut down brothels and gambling dens. But for generations, the white cops didn't really mind if brothels and gambling dens operated in the black part of town. And so the black cops want to shut her down, but she's very connected. She has a lot of strong relationships with some of the white officers. And she makes a habit of teasing the black cops because she feels that they may be cops, but she has connections that are going to allow her to outlast the cops, and that she even warns one of the new black cops, you know, in a few years, this little experiment's going to fail, and you're not going to be a cop anymore, but I'm still going to be here.
I know that this has been optioned for a series. I do think that the role of Mama Dove, actresses are going to fight over who gets to play that. Talking with Thomas Mullen, Decatur-based novelist of national renown. His latest novel is Darktown. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to City Lights on WABE Atlanta.
Support for WABE comes from Everything But The House, offering homeowners who are moving, downsizing, or remodeling a digital solution for selling household items digitally. More at ebth.com/NPR.
This election year has been a lot to take in. But through it all, NPR has been there to help you wade through it.
NPR's politics team has been
about some of the actual numbers and how the U.S.
NPR's
vets
Eric
refugees.
Westerveld looks at both sides of the debate over the cost of higher education.
Stay informed every day from now until November. Every weekday from 4 until 6:30, it's All Things Considered on 90.1 WABE.
You're listening to City Lights. I'm Lois Reitz. Is back now with Thomas Mullen talking about his latest novel, Darktown. And let's hear about the two main characters, Lucius Boggs and Tommy Smith.
Sure. So Boggs and Smith come from very different backgrounds. Lucius Boggs is the son of a preacher, and he has had a relatively privileged life. The Sweet Auburn community, which was the main black part of town in Atlanta, was a very vibrant community, and it had a very, you know, complex class structure. There were middle-class African Americans, there were wealthy African Americans. You know, there was a million-dollar black-owned bank, a million-dollar black-owned insurance company, and I wanted one of my characters to come from this, you know, privileged area. So he hasn't had, he's a smart guy, he's a Morehouse graduate, so obviously he knows all about racism, but at the same time, he hasn't had to deal with it in a day-in, day-out way as much as he might have, because he's grown up in this, you know, this bubble, this protective cocoon of wealthy black Atlanta. He's part of what W.E.B. Du Bois would have called the talented 10th, what was also called the Negro elite. And so raised by his father, he's been taught that, you know, he is a born leader and that it's his obligation to lead his people. So he's just come back from the war. He did not have a terribly good experience at war. And when he finds out, when the city announces that it will hire 8 black police officers, he feels a calling and he thinks that that is what he's meant to do. Although at the same time, because of his privileged background, he's not really cut out for police work, at least not initially. He's not used to the confrontations. He's not used to having his authority questioned. And he is a bit shocked at first by just how visceral racism is with the white officers. So his partner, Tommy Smith, does not come from such a privileged background. He was not a rich kid growing up. He has had to navigate more dangerous racial encounters every day of his life. So he's more street smart. He's more aware of the perils that lie all around them. And I think that's one of the tensions in the book, is that because these two men come from such different backgrounds, because they were raised so differently, they have different opinions about what to do about different problems. And when they face different obstacles, they have different ideas of how to solve them.
Tommy's also very handsome.
Yeah, Smith is a bit of a womanizer, and Boggs is, you know, preacher's son, so he's a kind of he tries to be a very morally upstanding young man, and he's a little blown away by some of the stuff his partner gets away with.
The weather is a main character. I don't know if you intended it that way, but I certainly felt it as a reader.
I don't know that I intended it, but you're not the first person to comment on it. So yeah, I am kind of obsessed with the weather.
Would you read about that page 35, please?
Sure. Summer weather in Atlanta came in one size, big. There were big storms and big winds when those storms came, and sometimes a big tornado afterward, then big floods. Or it was big heat, as though the sun had veered out of orbit and was pressing closer and closer, determined to exert itself on the personal space of everyone in the city, get right up next to you, breathe in your face, and laugh at your inability to do anything about it. The one fortunate thing about being on the night shift, Boggs figured, was that it was slightly less grueling to be walking around the city in the dark. But there's a famous quote from Elmore Leonard, you know, one of the all-time great crime writers. He wrote a top 10 writing tips list because so many people asked him, how do I be a good writer? So he finally wrote, I think it was run in the New York Times. And I believe rule number one was never write about the weather. And when I read that, I laugh. And my reply is, yeah, well, Elmore Leonard was from Michigan.
He didn't have to deal
with it. If I lived in Michigan, I might not have wanted to write about the weather much either. But to live in the South and not write about the weather, to me, that'd be like being a Hawaiian author and not writing about the ocean. It's kind of important.
Well, you even have Rakestraw during his World War II years longing for home and the thick, overwhelming ripeness of the South. Here's a quote. Southern hospitality was a delightful weapon to wield against people who don't want to talk to you. You're relatively new to Atlanta, Thomas. When did you first observe this?
I don't know. I mean, I've lived south of the Mason-Dixon line for 16 years now. The last eight have been in Atlanta. And being raised northern, you are raised with certain stereotypes about Southerners. And I'm certainly plead guilty to having some of those stereotyped visions in my head before I lived here. But I've also always been struck by the pride people have of living in the South. And sometimes that can be misinterpreted. Sometimes it is used badly, in my opinion, that Southern pride being equated with racism or nostalgia for antebellum South. And I obviously don't agree with that. But I think Northerners too often assume that anyone who has, Southern pride is therefore also racist or that there are issues there. And that's not the case. So in writing this book, obviously I'm writing a lot about race and racism, but I also wanted to tap into that, strong Southern pride that a lot of people feel. And so Rakestraw, again, he's a racial progressive, but he's been at war for 4 years. He is thrilled to be home. He loves Georgia. He loves the South. He never wants to leave again. And I wanted to be that. I wanted that love of the South to be an important part of his character.
I wish we had more time, but in the few moments we have left, the book is important enough because of its historical subject. Did you also intend to hold it up as a mirror to racial strife and police brutality today?
Well, I'll say yes and no. I started the book 4 years ago, so that would be the summer of 2012, and I was actually finishing a rough draft in the summer of 2014, which is when Michael Brown was killed and Ferguson exploded into riots. And that summer, there were so many events, Baltimore, Staten Island, that really put race and policing in the national spotlight in a way that they probably hadn't been since Rodney King when I was in high school. So this book was not a deliberate response or reaction to the recent spate of police brutality and the Black Lives Matter movement. because I was pretty much written it before then. But that being said, I think that race has always been a key issue in American history, and it's something that we're always grappling with. So in 2012, when I started the book, we still had Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. We still had a lot of, you know, racially coded criticism of President Obama. There's always something going on. It might not always be the big story in the media spotlight, but I do think race is just a vital issue in American history and in our present. And I think one of the fun things about historical fiction is that, as you say, it puts a mirror on our own times. We get to see all the differences between then and now, but we're also reminded of certain similarities between our time and then. And also it allows us to find some of the historical roots in issues that are still playing out today.
Thomas Mullen, it's been a privilege to talk with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The book is Darktown. There will be more about this, about Thomas Mullen and the other books he's written, on our website later today, wabe.org.